As we've been going through the songs of ascent, I just didn't feel like the other had to be in there. That's just between you and me. We're not going to tell anybody.
Katie says she liked them.
Well, there you go. That's the reason why I like Katie. Psalm 120 begins the Song of Ascent, and really, you know, as I've been thinking through some of the great hymns, there are wonderful pictures of this, you know, heading to Zion type thing, and that's what we're doing, if you think about it, as we've been going through Psalm 120 through 134, the 15 steps of the priest as they go into the holy place. And as well as many of the pilgrimage start heading to Jerusalem, they would go through these psalms or the songs of ascent in which they were ascending to Jerusalem. So what is it about? Well, it's about taking us to God. It's about that walk to God. It's one of the things that I had encouraged all of you to read was Pilgrim's Progress. And it gives that interesting picture of us progressing to that heavenly kingdom. Now, that doesn't mean that salvation is a progression. But what it means is that there is a journey that we take as we go into the house of God and we pursue God, and God begins to draw us to himself. There's a great hymn that I think I had Sonny sing a couple of times, that wonderful hymn, I'm Pressing on the Upward Way. And once again, let me just read some of the words in this particular song, because it so matches what we're looking at with the songs of ascent. I'm pressing on the upward way. New heights I'm gaining every day. Still praying as I onward bound, Lord, plant my feet on higher ground. Lord, lift me up and let me stand by faith on Canaan's table land, a higher plane than I have found. Lord, plant my feet on higher ground. My heart has no desire to stay where doubts arise and fears dismay. Though some may dwell where these abound, my prayer, my aim is higher ground. I want to live above the world, though Satan's darts at me are hurled. For faith has caught the joyful sound, the song of saints on higher ground. And the last verse is, I want to scale the utmost height and catch a gleam of glory bright. But still I pray till rest I found. Lord, lead me on to higher ground. It's a great, great hymn, isn't it? And if you think about it, if you look at Psalm 120, one of the things that is being said in this particular hymn is that the difficulties of this world has pressed me on to pursue that higher ground. And that really is the fundamental point of what we've been looking at in this particular text, are these different songs of ascent. If you look in Psalm 120 in particular, and if you'll drop on down to verse 5, you begin to see that part of what is coming into play is a sense of being uncomfortable with being in this world. There's just a time somewhere in people's life where they go, you know what? I don't think I belong anywhere on this earth. I mean, you just feel like a stranger and a pilgrim. And he literally describes that. If you look in verse 5, woe is me, for I sojourn in Meshach. I dwell among the tents of Kedar. The interesting picture of those particular places is Meshach seems to convey a drawing out and really kind of goes even to the realm of Russia. There's something that the world is drawing me away from God is the interesting picture of this. And I find myself in the tents of Kedar. Now, the tents of Kedar, Kedar is just a kind of another word for darkness. So I find myself not at home, but as a sojourner among and in obscurity and darkness. And you find yourself that way in the world, don't you? And so it's by virtue of those difficult things. Of course, the chapter starts off, how? In my troubles, I cried to you. So it was the afflictions, it was the troubles that brought me to this. And it caused me to feel not at home here. So the Psalm of Ascent starts with, you have to feel uncomfortable being here in order for you to head towards Zion. So all these are taking us to Zion as we go. As you come into Psalm 121, what's interesting is, as we just looked at that particular song, Lord, lift me up, but let's see, new heights I'm gaining, I'm onward bound, my heart, verse 3, I want to live above the world. That's an interesting, that's how he starts off in this particular hymn. So if you look in Psalm 121, what does he say? I lift my eyes to the mountains, from whence comes my help? Oh, beyond the mountains. My help comes from the Lord, who made heaven and earth. And there's this sense of, I've got to find a place that's safer than where I am, because I'm not finding any safety here. So once again, I want to live above the world. Though Satan's darts at me are hurled, for faith has caught the joyful sound, the song of saints. We're going on higher ground. And as the songs progress, you can feel the audience increasing. In other words, as they're making this trek, this pilgrimage to Jerusalem, you're picking up other pilgrims. And you begin to talk to one another and you go, you don't feel at home either on this earth? And they go, no, we don't feel at home either. Wow. So what is our home? And you begin to realize it's Zion. Zion's our home. So it's kind of like that one hymn, We're Marching to Zion. The way that particular hymn goes is this. Come we that love the Lord, and let our joys be made known. Join in a song with sweet accord. Join in a song with sweet accord, and thus surround the throne. And thus surround the throne. There's an interesting verse that comes into play here. Let those refuse to sing who never knew our God. I oftentimes think of that. Psalms chapter 50. In verse 16, God says, what right do you have to put my words in your mouth? Because you reject everything that I say. So that's an interesting chorus in here that the ungodly can't sing the song that we're singing. This is the song of, this is my home. I'm heading towards my home, this Jerusalem. And so wonderful pictures as you begin to see the hymns that in many respects have adopted and adapted themselves to these songs of ascent and have in some ways brought in that sense of feeling of what is going on within the passage. So Psalm 121 basically is, if you and I were walking on the road, we were heading to Jerusalem, just kind of picture this, because that's what we're doing really when you think about it. I mean, we're all heading home. This isn't our home, right? Peter will remind us we're strangers and aliens here. So we all begin to walk, and as we're talking to each other, we begin to share that trouble, that affliction that brought us to turn to God and caused us to take this trek. And as we begin to share with one another those particular moments and the difficulties, we then turn to each other and we say something like, so where does your help come from? And you can just hear the echo of the other guy. Well, my help comes from the Lord who made heaven and earth. And you begin marching just a little bit faster. Because by the time you come to 122, somebody walks up next to you and they go, let's go. Where are you going? Come on, come with us. Where are we going? We're going into the house. We're going in God's house. So how does it start off? I was glad when they said to me, let's go to the house of God. I mean, I just couldn't believe it. This is what I've been looking for. So you begin to feel the sense of even mystery within the passage, because he describes the Jerusalem, verse 3, if you look in 122, verse 3. How does he describe Jerusalem? compact place. Now, once again, the description of that word in the Hebrew is that people are joined together by virtue of a mystery. So he says, here we are, a city, and you drew next to me, and I drew next to you, and we've become a family. We don't even know how this happened. Yeah. I made a call last night to India and talked to Robinson and Molly. I always get a kick out of talking with them. And I said, you know, we're family. And I said, we love each other. And he was asking when next time I was coming over, I put him off. But I really would like to go. I told him, I said, I really would like to come again. But I said, I have my folks, so I'm taking care of them right now. But I said, I think the Lord's going to work it out. But we began sharing with each other, and how would you describe them? Giddy?
They were excited.
And you know, when I make that contact with them every time, there is a sense of it's like we never parted from each other. And he was reminding me that we've been together 17 years, so that's a little bit of a trek together. But what a wonderful thing to know that we have family. Think about it, family. And you're drawn close to people, and you don't even know why. Well, you do. It's a mysterious force that draws us together. It's the love for Christ that draws us together. And it's really inexplicable in the sense that you can't nail it in some scientific formula, but you know that I'm drawn to that person, and our hearts are drawn together. And so we have this, as it's worded in here, compact city in which our hearts are united and drawn together. It's a great picture, isn't it? So Psalm 122 takes us that next step, and you feel yourself almost at the gates of the house, so to speak, and getting ready to come in. You go to Psalm 123, and the pronouns begin to change all the way through, because you're not only from 120, really is more the singular, but as you go into 121, 122, and now 123, you begin to bring others into the things that you're going through, and the sense of we're coming before the Lord, and we all want to serve Him. And we all kind of sit around the throne with great anticipation, waiting for Him to give the word of grace to us. And like a servant would sit before their master and wait for him to wave his hand. Because really the world that we're in is full of acrimony and hate and contempt. And that's what he says in verse 3. Be gracious to us, O Lord, be gracious to us, for we are greatly filled with contempt. Our soul is greatly filled with the scoffing of those who are at ease. That's the world that we live in. But we're sitting before him, and the description is in verse 2, behold, the eyes of the servants look to the hand of their masters, as the eyes of the maid to the hand of her mistress, so our eyes look to the Lord for God until, what are they looking for? Until he's gracious to us. We can hardly wait. Because we're coming out of a world that is very ungracious. But we've come into a home in which the one in charge just wants to give us things. It's quite a great picture that is. And what's also interesting is that whole plural sense of us. Because it starts off, to thee I lift my eyes, but then it goes, so our eyes look to the Lord, our God. Mm-hmm. And you begin to see everybody being brought in the process. In 124, we begin to encourage this sense of, let's let everybody say this. And you can, once again, you can feel that that sense of testimony, and that testimony inspiring others to say the same thing. I mean, the difficulties that you had, what happened? Well, the Lord came to me. I mean, he helped me. He rescued me. He cared for me. Well, you know what? Had the Lord not been on my side, I don't know what I would have done. And you go, yeah, that's true of all of us. Had the Lord not been on our side. So you see that at the beginning, right? Had the Lord not been on our side, let Israel now say, let everybody say. That's true. Had the Lord not been on our side, when men rose up against us, they would have swallowed us alive. That's a great description, isn't it? So let's all say this, because there is a realization of God's greatness to us. So we encourage that sense of heightened awareness of what God has done and his grace in our lives. And it's almost like we're forming a choir of great praise. And so you come to Psalm 125, and we find ourselves on that Mount Zion. Beautiful, beautiful Zion, right? And those who trust the Lord are as Mount Zion. Now, the point of the text is that Mount Zion can't be moved because it's controlled by the Lord himself. So the interesting picture is that I feel secure and safe on Mount Zion. I think it's one of the things that needs to be conveyed within any church, is when people walk through the door, they need to feel a sense of safe and secure. I'm not going to be pushed around. I'm not going to be made fun of. I'm not going to be, people are actually going to care about the things that are going on in my life. And I'm not going to feel intimidated, you know, like, of course, the Pharisees would do religiously. But here's a place where people can walk in the door and go, you know, they love God, they love his people, I'm at home. And it should be this. It doesn't mean that there won't be correction and direction, but the point is that this is a place that loves me. And anything that is said will be done out of love and caring. So that wonderful picture that is being given is, as the mountains surround Jerusalem, so, verse 2, the Lord surrounds. You can feel the embrace, can't you? You can really feel the embrace. So I'll climb to the place of God's embrace. And Mount Zion really is the only place I feel stable and secure. I'm surrounded by the peace of God, literally. I'm surrounded by the peace of God. And that's the point of that particular psalm. Psalm 126, you know, it's one of the most gracious acts that God bestows upon us, in that oftentimes he takes away those very things that are valuable so that we might truly appreciate what is of great worth. And so you see this wonderful picture of literally the Israelites going into captivity, and now they get to go home. And what a great psalm that is, that Psalm 126. We couldn't believe it. You can just hear him saying it. Can you believe it? We're going home. Can you believe it? I can't believe it. And everybody was pinching each other as they're heading around. Our mouth was filled with laughter, our tongue with joyful shouting. They said among the nations, the Lord has done great things. No, we said among ourselves, the Lord has done great things. Restore the captivity like streams of the south. We sowed in tears, but we're going to reap in joy. That's a great psalm, isn't it? So, you know, I think, I look at these psalms as a lot my own personal journey, and I would hope that you would see it that way too with yourselves. But through the process of many things in my life, the Lord has made me homesick for true, for real, for genuine. I mean, isn't that what you long for? Mm-hmm. Well, if that's true, then you've been in some bondage. You've been in places in which you had affliction. You've been in a place in which you were held captive. The world was beating you up. But it was a wonderful thing, because at that moment you began to really long for home. And it is what made you embrace home. So it's a great picture as you look at Psalm 126. 127 reminds us that if in fact we're going to build anything of any value that will last at all, it has to be God who does it. And it is probably one of the greatest reminders to me of all Scripture, because you know, unless God does it, it's just not going to last. There's nothing eternal in anything that I do. PsPsalm 49, man in his pomp is like the beast that perishes, right? So his point is that though he names his lands after him, and his thoughts are that he's going to live forever, he's just like the beast that perishes, Psalm 49. So the point of this particular psalm is that sense of realization that I have to understand that only God can build something lasting. And it just, to me, it just really nails it. Without him, nothing I do matters. Think about that. Without God, nothing. So you can be the greatest parent in the world. You can have the best education in the world. You can have a great career. Nothing you do matters unless God builds it. So, great text, and you begin to see that any gift that comes out of anything, anything that you possess of any value is literally a gift from God. We're reminded of in James chapter 1, every good and perfect gift comes from God, from the Father of lights with whom there is no variance or shadow shifting. So a great psalm, Psalm 127. Once again, you're feeling these things in the progression of life. And it may not have hit on in the perfect progression of your life exactly the way this is. But these things, if in fact you're journeying to the Lord, are stirring in your hearts. And God is using them. Come to Psalm 128, and there is an understanding then, if God's the only one that builds the home at last, that blessings only come when he's revered. The word that's used is that those who fear the Lord. And then it begins to describe all the blessings. Now, the blessings that it describes, I mean, your wife shall be fruitful and divine within your house. Your children will be like olive plants around your table. Behold, this is the man who's blessed by God. But why is he blessed by God? Verse 4. Why? Yeah, and if you pick up at the very beginning, verse 1, how blessed is everyone who what? Right. Who fears the Lord. So can there be any blessing when God is not exalted to his highest place? It's one of the things that is just very destructive in households. People are wondering, why is my household not being blessed? And I'm going, well, who's exalted? Well, kids first. Okay, well, I'll tell you that's why you're going to have problems. They're not going to be blessings that surround your household. You know, I mean, there'll be a facsimile of nice, but there's not going to be the blessings that are real. If you want the true blessings, only one is to be exalted. And you want to convey that to the household. We're going to put God first in everything we do. If you want the blessings of God. If you don't want the blessings of God, well, do everything you've been doing other than that. I'll revere the Lord above all, that all would be blessed. We believe that God has to be honored above all. Psalm 129, I'm going to cultivate in such a way as to receive only the blessings from on high, which means that there are going to be times in which we're going to suffer difficulties and hardships and bear the hurts and the pains of others. But this one thing we're going to know, God is using that to plant seed of blessing for me. I really believe that, don't you? Any difficult, any problem, any severity that I'm suffering, I mean, it feels like they're walking on my back. Isn't that the way it reads? It feels like they're plowing my back. They are. But what they don't know is they're plowing blessings. And what's going to happen is I'm going to reap these blessings, and they're not. You know, I found that those that live in a world of great entitlement and everybody is giving them stuff, end up to be such miserable people. But those who have suffered loss and difficulty and hardship and oftentimes have been the Cinderella of the house, with the stepsisters beating her up, has come out gracious and loving and kind, and you begin to see, well, righteousness has been cultivated in that house. And God has been using that to humble, because unless we're humble, Bob and I were talking about this before the study, that you want to know what crazy is? Crazy is pride. So if you ever want to know what causes crazy, because you know, people are really concerned about crazy nowadays, especially with all the crazies out there. So you have to ask yourself, where did that come from? And there actually is a poster boy in Scripture for crazy, and his name is Nebuchadnezzar. But if you remember in that chapter 4 of Daniel, where did crazy start? Well, crazy started when he elevated himself above all his kingdom and he said, I did this. I made this happen. And then what happens? He loses his mind. Right. When does he gain his senses? When he admits that the Lord on high, not him. Right. This is why Romans chapter 12 says, don't think more highly of as you ought of yourself, but to each one has been given sound judgment. So you don't want to get that pride in the way, because it's very destructive and it'll make you go crazy. So if pride will make you go crazy, what makes you go sane?
Humility.
Brokenness. Bring it back every time. It's a great picture. But anyway, as we come to Psalm 129, there is that realization that I'm being cultivated and for blessings, and the difficulties are actually God bringing that in my life. We come to Psalm 130 now, and we begin sharing the depths of despair. Why would I say the depths of despair? Because he says depths. That was a test. Verse 1, out of the depths I have cried, is how he starts off within the passage, and I cry to thee, O Lord. Now, as he begins to cry, he wants, I always think this is interesting when he interjects, instead of what he's saying, he wants the Lord to hear his voice. I've always thought that was a bit interesting, don't you? Because what he's wanting to convey is, you can say something in a monotone and people go, okay, I'm not going to take him seriously. I don't really sense that they're in the game here. But you cry out something, even if you don't understand what the person is saying, you go, I hear your voice, and I can tell you're wrenched over this. So his cry to the Lord is, you got to hear where I'm coming from, because this is my heart. This is what I long for. Let thine ears be attentive, once again, to what? Yeah, the voice of the supplications. Now, supplication is you coming to God and longing for his favor. That's probably the best description I can give you for a supplication as you go on. So the longing is, if we're just to kind of transliterate it, the longing would sound something like this. Be gracious to me. There's that sense of, you know, I've got to feel your grace upon me, because I'm not feeling any grace anywhere else. I've got to have it from you. And there are times in our life, clearly, where it is, you know, we've read a number of the Psalms with David, where it seems like, everybody's abandoned us and we're all alone and there's nobody or nothing that has given us any kind of affirmation at all. But that's the time that you really get real with only hearing from God. And believe me, when you come with this kind of heart, you'll hear from him. And the God of all comfort, I mean, isn't that what it says in 2 Corinthians 1? He's the God of all comfort. So what do you think he's going to do? He'll comfort us in all of our affliction. So what a great reminder. So he cries unto the Lord with the voice of supplications, and there is a realization of why he's crying in verse 3. The realization is his own sin. and probably the greatest form of guilt is self-guilt. Because if in fact you believe that you're doing the right thing and you're on the right track, no matter what other people say, you have great confidence and great assurance. But if you feel like you did something that caused this whole chain of events to happen, then the guilt is just, I mean, it just won't let you go. So the path, the way it reads is, God, if you should mark our transgressions, if you would guard, to use an interesting Hebrew word within the text, if you would guard our focus on my iniquity, on the sins of my rebellion, the sins of my guilt. Obviously, he's making reference to that I'm clearly guilty of what is there. You know, those moments where you know you're wrong, everybody else knows you're wrong, of course, God knows you're wrong. So it's not like you can hide anywhere. And he goes, if you were to focus on this, I couldn't stand. I'm not going to make it. I'm not going to make it. So if thou, Lord, should mark iniquities, O Lord, who could stand? You consider one interesting Psalm chapter 90, if you look there with me, kind of feel that sense of overwhelmingness of the sin in our lives. In this particular psalm, he begins to share how frail he is and how easily he feels that he could be swept away. The years of our life are like nothing before God. Even if we were to live 1,000 years, verse 4, it's not anything to God. So we're basically nothing in that sense. And thou hast swept them away like a flood. He's talking about man and how, you know, transient he is. In the morning they are like grass which sprouts anew. In the morning it flourishes, it sprouts anew. Toward the evening it fades and withers away. That's how quickly we come and go. I remember it having described to me, you put your finger in water, you take it out, that's about how much difference you make in the world. But we've been consumed by thy anger and by thy wrath. We have been dismayed. Thou hast placed our iniquities, well, that's the last thing we want, before thee, our secret sins in the light. Think about your secret sins. Can we? You want to share? Who wants to be first? So, our secret sins in the light of his presence. I can't think of anything that'd be worse. All our days of decline and fury, we have finished our years like a sigh. As for the days of our life, they contain 70 years. By the way, that's how long David lived. Or if due strength, 80 years, yet the pride is their labor and sorrow, for soon it's gone and we fly away. Who understands the power of thine anger and the fury according to the fear that is due thee? So teach us to number our days that we may present thee a heart of wisdom. Do return, Lord, how long will it be? Just pity us, basically. Oh, satisfy us with the morning of thy loving kindness. Sing for joy. Make us glad again. Because we've certainly been afflicted by these things. And there's clearly a realization that that he has sinned. The same thing is found in Psalm 38, if you look there with me. And it just, not only do you realize how transient you are, but your anxieties over your sin just makes your life miserable. So it's bad enough that your life is short, but now it's short and miserable. So it says, there's no soundness in my flesh. Why? Verse 3, because of indignation. There's no health in my bones because of my sin. It was my fault. It was my fault. For my iniquities are gone over my head. It's a heavy burden. They weigh too much for me. My wounds grow foul and fester. He says in verse 6, I'm bent over, greatly bowed down. Verse 7, my loins are filled with burning. There is no soundness in my flesh. Verse 8, I am benumbed, badly crushed. I groan because of the agitation of my heart. Well, at least your loved ones are going to comfort you. Oh, wait a minute. Verse 11, my loved ones and my friends stand aloof from my plague. Talking about bad to worse, right? I mean, I just feel like a deaf man. I don't hear. You ever just felt numb? Yeah, that's what he's talking about. He knows what he needs to do. Verse 18, I confess my iniquity because I am full of anxiety. What's bringing the anxiety? Sin. Right? The sin. So it's that guilt of not only will your family and friends oftentimes not comfort you and find themselves, you know, thinking, okay, there's no hope for them, already given up on them. But in addition to that, you have your enemies looking to destroy you at your weakest moment. And so he kind of interposes this in verse 19, but my enemies are vigorous and strong, and many are those who hate me wrongfully. I mean, it's bad enough that people hate you for the wrong that you did, but then they add other stuff in addition. So, I mean, you know, if you're going down, you might as well throw all the other weights with you as well. That kind of feeling in this passage is, you know, who could stand if, I mean, you can feel a person so weighed down with the burdens of their sins. Sin fundamentally has its own torture. Family standing aloof is an add-on to that, and then your enemies on top of that just nail the coffin. But the change in the whole feeling of this is verse 4 of Psalm 130, and that is, but there is forgiveness. It's that one little word. It's in the Hebrew, it's kai, is the but, is kai. And the point is, it changes everything. It's the one clause that is the game changer of everything, that there is forgiveness with him. Did you forget that? Casting all your cares upon him, for he cares. Did you forget that he actually cares for you? Did you forget, according to Isaiah 30, that he longs to be gracious? Did you forget that if you confess your sins, he is faithful and just to forgive? He wants to forgive you. As powerfully as I want to be forgiven, he wants to forgive me more. But there is forgiveness with thee, that thou mayest be feared. Now, you wouldn't think that forgiveness would create fear. It almost seems inappropriate to stick that phrase in there. But what he's talking about is this, that, and it's kind of understood in the Hebrew language, but that when you're forgiven, in a moment when you don't think that you could have ever imagined that happening, it draws you so near to the person. And this is the picture that's in the text. It draws you so near to the person that you get closer to them than you ever have before. And it's awe-inspiring. That's the picture. That's a great picture, isn't it? Because it is that moment of the forgiveness in your life. I mean, I remember as a kid going in certain places that I'd never been in before, and someone going, come on, you can come on in. You're going, I don't think I can. No, come on, you can come in. And you come in, and you go, oh, I'm in. It's probably some little hut or something. But, yes, sir. Well, you know, it's much like Psalm 51 says, against thee and thee alone have I sinned.
Right.
Right. So, and as Jesus will say, who can forgive, or as the Pharisees will even say, who can forgive sins but God alone? Mm-hmm. So, absolutely. Yeah. And what is also interesting about that particular word, because it's actually in the plural abstract, which means the phrase forgiveness, which actually means that it is abundant forgiveness. Plural aspect is conveying that not just one time. Of course, 70 times seven. The desire to give, to forgive always, multiplied. So you would actually describe the phrase, but there is abundant forgiveness with thee, that thou mayest be feared. It creates a sense of awe. I mean, it brings me into your presence, and I understand the greatness of who you are, and I'm astonished that you would do this. Verse 5, the result of this, if you look in the text, is basically saying this in verse 5, as I'll wait for you. Now, because it's a result, it's in what is called the perfect, which means from now on I'm going to completely wait for you to do everything in my life. I'm not going to call the shots anymore. You're the one that's going to be in control of literally everything in my life. So I wait for the Lord. My soul, if you look there, does wait. Now, why would he emphasize soul within the text? And the answer is because soul really describes and emphasizes your emotions. And it focuses largely on your passions that you have. So what he's conveying is that this moment of forgiveness has stirred me so intensely that every fiber of my being wants to wait only for you. Somebody walk up to you and go, don't you want to talk to somebody else? No. I'm only going to wait on him. And it just draws us to that point of loyalty, I would guess you would put it. And it goes on and says in verse 5, and in his word, and he uses devar, which is very similar to the Greek logos, which is the intent of God. In other words, I want to know what God wants, not just what he says. So logos in the Greek, in John chapter 1, is made mention in the word, but you come to the Hebrew and it's devar. But the emphasis is the same, and that is, it's the intent and the heart and the purpose that God has. And the point is I want to know what he wants. I desire to be in line with how he moves. I don't want to just hear the words of the commandments. What are you looking for? You know, you go to that wonderful picture of the woman at the well that we oftentimes go back to, and you realize that Jesus makes it so clear, you know, the Father and I are looking for two things, spirit and truth. So the Father and I are looking for those that will be genuine and real about this walk. And lo and behold, genuine and real is found in very strange places. Have you noticed that? And if you look at the Gospel of John, I mean, you're looking at a woman at the well, you're looking at a blind guy, you're going, really? Because I would think you would go to the seminary halls. And Jesus goes, no, we've already passed those. That's how I got these fisher guys. So all these guys, whether it be Nathaniel, you know, I like this guy because he's guileless. I mean, he tells me what he really thinks, and he thinks that Nazareth stinks. I get it. But I appreciate the fact that you're coming clean about this. And, you know, God finds these people. And when we look at them in a distance, we're going, do you know that's Samaritan? Do you know that that's, I mean, this is a sinner, you know? And God goes, yeah, I get it. But she's the only real person I have seen in this whole area. So he goes to her. And It's the heart of God. So it's like we're coming to God and we're going, you know, I just want to know what you really want. And he goes, I'm going to tell you. I mean, if you search for him, he will let you find him. Is that Steve's your favorite verse? Is that your theme verse? Is that? We'll call it your theme verse. I like it. So wait for the Lord, my soul does wait, and his word do I hope. And as we look at this word hope and have been looking at it in 1 Thessalonians, I mean, it clearly, in many respects, is conveying that same thought of he causes me to, and by the way, it's in the causative, which means that God is causing me to expect great things. Why? Go back. Because he just forgave you of everything. You know, if you haven't been forgiven of everything, let me tell you what you expect. Judgment. But if he forgives you of everything, then there's only one thing left. Good. That's the only thing left. So you expect great things. And what he's virtually saying is, because of God's graciousness and his forgiveness towards me, I'm expecting great things to happen. And the wonderful fact that we live a life of confident expectation in the future. My soul waits for the Lord more, look at the phrase here, I like the description, more than the watchman for the morning. You know why the watchmen were waiting for the morning? Because they were coming out of obscurity, they were coming out of darkness, and they were coming out of fear. Because the enemy you can't see in the darkness. But the light comes, and everybody breathes okay. And what a great picture that is. More than the watchman for the morning, literally a figurative way of describing bright joy after distress of the darkness in your life. And literally the word morning is daybreak. That's where we get the word daybreak. O Israel, verse 7, hope in the Lord. Now, what's interesting is that what's just happened is my testimony of what God has done for me has caused me to want others to experience this. So we become, as it were, a billboard of hope. And one of the great reasons why God brings us through difficult times, so that we might be those people that go, no, it really works. Because you go through trials and you go through difficulties, and if in fact you've never you can't walk up to somebody and comfort somebody with the comfort by which you've been comforted, according to 2 Corinthians chapter 1. But once you can and once you have, then you can tell them, no, it works. You have something to look forward to. I oftentimes tell people, have you hit your bottom? And they go, I've hit the bottom. And I go, well, great. We're at the greatest point in your whole life. How do you know? Because I've done that. I've felt that. I know what that looks like. And I also know what it looks like if you'll cry to God, what will happen? Because with him is forgiveness. How great that is. O Israel, hope in the Lord. For with the Lord, there is chesed, there is loving kindness. And really the emphasis of chesed is, and King James oftentimes translates it merciful or mercy, but the emphasis of the word is a zeal to be loving. God is zealous to be loving. You know, of all the thoughts that you could have of God, most people don't think of him that way. Yes, he is great, and you should think of him as great, but the zeal of love is that which takes the throne in heaven, because at his right hand are pleasures forevermore. And that's his right hand is what he exalted above all kingdoms. So, O Israel, hope in the Lord, for with the Lord there is loving kindness, and with him, oh, there's that word abundant, because we were talking about verse 4, abundant forgiveness. There is abundant redemption. Yeah. It's hard to imagine that that God would long to redeem me, feeling as worthless as we oftentimes do, especially in the depths of our despair. I mean, you can't feel more worthless than when you're there. But the point of the passage is that's when God paid the most for us. Paul will write something like this, while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. And you know, one of my favorite verses that deal with this is Colossians. If you looked at it with me in Colossians, I don't have a lot of time to look at a lot of other passages, but that Colossians, I mean, God is all in all, right? It's one of the great themes that we read in the book of Colossians. But if you look with me in particular in Colossians chapter 2, and if you'll drop on down within the passage in which he begins to say this in verse 13, "And when you were dead in your transgressions and the uncircumcision of your flesh, he made you alive together with him." Watch the phrase. "Having forgiven us." I can't believe it. All? Watch this, verse 14. "Having canceled out the certificate of debt that you owed." He canceled it, consisting of decrees against us, in which was hostile to us, and he has taken it out of the way. He nailed it to the cross. And then what does he do? Well, he disarms all the rulers and authorities that would have triumphed over our demise. That's what he does. I mean, what a great picture that is. He canceled that debt. That's redemption, isn't it? That's him. I mean, the world's telling you, you're worthless. And God says, oh, not to me. Now, Peter will say, he purchased you, but not with silver and gold. No, blood. And it was his blood. So, oh, Israel, hope in the Lord. For with the Lord there is, a desire to be loving. And with him there is abundant. And actually, in this particular phrase, it conveys a multiplication of redemption. The best picture I could give you would be that he's not going to run out of money. Right? Out of the abundance of his desire to save. Verse 8, watch. I like the emphatic imperative within the text, the dogma in the passage, because it's the dogma that is doctrine, and it's a doctrine that anchors your soul. In other words, if I were to say to you, it might happen, it could happen someday, iffy at best, there's no confidence in any of that. But when you hear, thus says God, it will not change, you go, okay, I can hang my hat on that. So verse 8, and he will redeem Israel from all his iniquities. That is so comforting. And it really is establishing within this particular passage just how great God's forgiveness is and how extensive it is in so many ways of our lives. If we would embrace this, we would be walking around free. And this is what God calls us to do, because we know Galatians chapter 5, that it was for freedom that Christ came to set us free. And I've often said that when we share the gospel, our main call is to be freeing agents. We're trying to take the burdens off the people. So you have to be careful how you share the gospel, because sometimes we can put more burdens on than we're taking off. And yes, they need to understand their guilt. But I was talking to my oldest son not too long ago, and he says, "Dad," he says, "one thing I've realized, you seldom have to remind people that they're sinners." He said, "Most of them know it already." He said, "What you have to remind them of is God's grace." And that's what a great picture that is, and a good reminder of. And this particular psalm is just taking that next step, in which we're bringing. We're not only recipients of hope, we're bringing others to hope. And this takes us to a different level. Because up to that point, I think it's been more the rejoicing and more the, acquiring for ourselves, and you know, there's a wonderful joy in fellowship. But that God would use my difficulties to bring somebody else to hope. How wonderful that is. I mean, what could be any better? I mean, you begin to realize that everything in your life has meaning and purpose, and that God was orchestrating your testimony so that you can talk to somebody that nobody else can, and they'll understand what you went through, and that moment they'll be enlightened. And they'll go, so I have a life worth living. And you go, yeah. Father, we give you thanks for a hope that is not going to leave us, and hope that's sure and steadfast. We have been talking about hope through the book of Thessalonians, but in this wonderful psalm, we realize that we are agents to proclaim hope. And it is by virtue of us experience the reality of you coming through for us and your total forgiveness of all of our failings that we realize that this message is not about us declaring our greatness at all. Our testimony has everything to do with declaring how wonderful you are and how weak we were, but how great that is because you loved us. We give you thanks in Jesus' name.